Our first case is People versus Flockhart, case number 2010-SC-218. Are both parties ready? Thank you. A couple of housekeeping matters. The people will have to keep track of your time as the appellant. The case is set for an hour, half an hour aside, and please tell us your name when you start your argument and who you represent. And I do want to tell you, and for the benefit of the audience, that we have on our iPads all the cases, a link to Westlaw, and also to our notes. So some of us at least do that. And so during the argument, we'll be using that. We're not surfing the net. So with that, we're ready to proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee on behalf of the people, bar number 38141. Because this is a cross-petition case, I think it probably makes most sense for the argument to follow the format of the briefs. So if it suits the court, I'm just going to begin with the issues addressed in the people's opening brief.
That'd be fine, I think. Is that okay with you, Mr. Kraft?
Yes. In reaching judgments that foreclosing trial courts from both allowing pre-deliberation and hearing challenges for cause in the presence of the jury, the Court of Appeals erred in endorsing a view of the jury, a dismissive and adverse view of the jury that this court has gone to great lengths to reject. In Colorado, the rule has long been that we trust that juries are worthy and willing to fulfill their constitutional duty, and we recognize that by second-guessing their ability to be fair, we only undermine the integrity and functioning of the entire system. That guiding principle controls this case. Starting with the pre-deliberation issue, in this case, the majority of the Court of Appeals reversed the defendant's conviction because the trial court allowed the jury to pre-deliberate before final deliberations. In the trial court's instruction, it advised the jury that they were not to come to any firm conclusions, but when they were all together, they would be permitted to discuss the evidence in the case. The Court of Appeals' holding is wrong. It's wrong for three reasons. First, by focusing its analysis on whether or not pre-deliberation was a part of conventional practice, the Court of Appeals swept away this court's jurisprudence, which sets forth the test that we actually look at whether jury procedures help the jury reach the truth. Second, the five reasons that the Court of Appeals cited to support its rule are all based on observations of human behavior that have no empirical support and rests on critical errors of logic. And third, the Court of Appeals ignored that pre-deliberation can enhance your decision-making ability. Turn to the first.
Sleek, can I ask you a question
Absolutely.
About that? I thought you had a lot of helpful authorities in your brief. But at least our research did not reveal any empirical research dealing with pre-deliberation in criminal cases and the impact one way or the other. And also, the only research, jurisdiction I could find was Indiana permits pre-deliberation, jury pre-deliberation in a criminal case. And I'm wondering, have you any other information or any other to support from an empirical perspective? Or is there, I couldn't find a decision in Indiana, but I don't know if maybe you weren't thorough enough. Have you had anything else to add to that?
I did pretty exhaustive research, and I think there's a lot of authority cited in the brief. The one case where it was allowed is the Williams v. Maryland case, where the court found it's in the brief, where they found that pre-deliberation did not constitute error. It's
criminal case.
It is. It did stop short of authorizing in all cases, but it did find that in the circumstances of that case, that allowing pre-deliberation did not constitute reversible error. As far as empirical evidence goes, Your Honor is absolutely correct that the research is far stronger in civil and criminal. I would point this court to our own research in Colorado about how successful pre-deliberation was in civil cases. And reinforce that with the point that we allow it in civil cases in Colorado, And I just don't think it's hard to draw a line if it's permissible in civil cases, then it will also be permissible in criminal cases.
Why do you say that?
In both cases, I think you have the right to an impartial jury. And if the process of pre-deliberation itself doesn't subvert it in a civil case, I don't know how it subverted in a criminal case.
What about shifting? I mean, the classic answer to that, I suppose, is that it would shift the burden of proof subtly so that if jurors start to pre-deliberate or deliberate, they might say, well, okay, we're all agreed now that we think so far that he's guilty, but let's see what he comes up with to show us that he's not, which would be the subtle shifting of the burden.
Yeah, sure. A couple of responses. First, that, to the extent that that's true, that's going to happen whether we pre-deliberate or not. If jurors make unconscious or conscious judgments about the evidence as it goes, no matter what, the people were always going to present our evidence first. So to the extent that these judgments are being made, I don't think it's a byproduct of pre-deliberation or no pre-deliberation. It's going to happen regardless. If you allow pre-deliberation, you have an express instruction like we have in this case, there's the benefit that the jury is expressly instructed that although they're going to draw these conclusions, which I submit they always draw, but they have to keep an open mind till the end. So in order for this court to find that it's impermissible in criminal cases, I think it has to take the chief step argument, neither one of which works, neither one of which I think holds true, that it only happens in pre-deliberation cases and not regular deliberation cases, and two, that the jury's not going to follow the court's express instructions to hold the people to the burden of proof, to apply the presumption of innocence to the defendant, and to not reach any firm conclusions.
Do you think there would be any separate constitutional problem, not with regard to the benefits of doing this, but simply a separate constitutional problem in criminal cases if you have alternates involved?
Let me answer that two ways, not as a matter of law and certainly not as a matter of fact in this case.
Is that because there were no alternates here, or we know they didn't participate, or?
It's a little tricky, but let me go through the factual thing. Okay, so the court impaneled one additional alternate, and I think that's volume 8, page 19, where it says it's taking 13 out of 12. We go through trial, we get through half a witness. The court, because there's no storm, it sends the jury home. The next morning, when the jury comes back in the room, it advises the jury, well, as you're aware, if you're missing a juror, we had to excuse that juror. So under the court's instructions, they were advised they could only pre-deliberate if all the jurors were in the room. So I think this case is kind of unique in the sense that that alternate possibility isn't actually possible in this case.
So they only got instructed that they could pre-deliberate after there was no longer an alternate juror? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. What I'm saying is they were told they could only pre-deliberate. Sorry, I missed the first premise. They were told they could only discuss the evidence when they're all present in the same room. We kind of have a unique record in that they were never really given an opportunity to all be in the same room before the alternate was excused.
And so just to move that over, maybe you could answer more generally for me. When it comes to us coming up with a rule or deciding whether, as the Court of Appeals seems to say, that you could never give an instruction that allows pre-deliberation, if we were to decide that you could, would that require some specific dealing with alternates? I guess where I'm going with that is, would there be a constitutional problem with an alternate participating in any way in pre-deliberation discussions if that person didn't wind up sitting on the jury?
Yeah, sure. I do first want to put out that we definitely don't have that constitutional problem in this case. But to hit that directly for the more general question, it would not violate the Constitution. It's not a fundamental, it's not a procedural due process problem having an extra juror sit for or being part of the original discussions. It's still intrinsic to the case. They're not bringing anything from the outside. They're just talking about the evidence. And I think this court's cases are pretty clear that that doesn't violate.
And maybe you could pursue that just a little, only because I haven't followed this up except what you all have raised, and you didn't, nobody seems to have raised that directly as a problem. But in our far distant past, haven't we in the past actually reversed convictions or held that if an alternate was present at any time in the deliberation room, that that was constitutional error? You were deprived of your right to a jury trial. Jury trials require the secrecy of deliberation only amongst those who will wind up sitting. Or am I wrong on that?
Well, I think the case you're referring to would be Boulos, which is the 1984 case where this court said it reversed because an alternate was present during final deliberations. Mm-hmm. And the concern that, as you understated, was juror secrecy. I don't think that concern is implicated generally with pre-deliberation, because the jurors are instructed that their original discussions are not their final deliberations. So the concern implicated in Bullis isn't, or Bullis is not implicating cases of pre-deliberation, because I think the concern in Bullis was that it either chills jury deliberations, because they're afraid that by expressing what they think about the case in front of a juror who's not actually going to vote, that somehow chills what they're going to say. That's not present in this case, because if during pre-deliberation, everyone knows that what they say isn't going to be, it's not their final decision. It's not their absolute judgment. So I think the concern in Bullis isn't implicated by jury deliberation. And then the other case, I guess, in Colorado that tangentially would hit this would be Burnett, which is the court's case in 88, where an alternate was put in after the jury had begun deliberating. And the concern in that case was just that because the court did not give sufficient instructions to the jury that they should allow, that they should be willing to hear that juror's point of view, that it didn't constitute a sufficient verdict. And of course, that's not implicated in this case. To hit the question more directly for why we generally, apart from just distinguishing the case law in the state, for why it doesn't violate due process, nothing about allowing a juror to speak with other jurors about the evidence violates due process on the simple ground that we don't know how it's going to break. Due process isn't concerned with how a jury reaches a verdict, it's just whether or not they're going to reach the right verdict. And by allowing pre-deliberation, it doesn't favor one side or the other. And I really think this is the key to why it doesn't violate due process. Jurors are going to find, or just as likely to find flaws in the evidence, even if the people go first, as they are to find it supportive. So the very fact that this process in itself does not benefit one side or the other, I think makes it absolutely not a violation of due process.
Sweet. You noted that in this case, the specific instruction required all the jurors to have those conversations while all of them are present in the room. Do you find that to be, or would you suggest that that is a necessary condition to any rule with respect to pre-deliberation discussions?
I would, Your Honor. One of the traditional concerns for why pre-deliberation should not be allowed, and one that the Court of Appeals cited, is the idea that it undermines collective collaboration and group decision making. And so one of the ways that we prevent that is by allowing pre-deliberation only when all the jurors are present. That way we maintain, I think, kind of the underlying idea of the jury system is that collective decision making is better than individual decision making. Group knowledge and group memory is always going to be stronger than individual knowledge and individual memory, which I think is, you know, one of the primary benefits of pre-deliberation in the first place. But that does require having all the jurors together in the room at the same time when this is occurring. Okay, so I think defense counsel's argument and really the threshold premise for the Court of Appeals analysis was that we should not allow pre-deliberation in Colorado because it departs from conventional practice. And that conclusion flouts this court's repeated assertions that that's not how we look at jury procedures. We take the pragmatic approach of looking at whether the jury procedure in fact enhances the jury's ability to find the truth. Starting with Wilson in 1938, when this court started allowing trial exhibits against the common rule to go back to the jury, juror note-taking. This court has a history of actually looking at whether the jury procedure in fact meets its intended ends and evaluating whether or not it's correct. So the simple fact that it's not permitted by conventional practice, I don't think is sufficient to lead this court to hold that pre-deliberation should not be permitted. As for the grounds in favor of pre-deliberation, the Court of Appeals, the defendant, and I think pretty much every court to say that pre-deliberation is not permissible, generally raises five concerns. And that's on page 27 of my opening brief. I think we've hit a couple of them already. The collective decision-making, that's just not present in this case because the jury was able, they were told that they could only collaborate when they were together. We have the jury should not be allowed to pre-deliberate because they're not instructed. In this case, they were given full instructions at the beginning of voir dire and before opening statements, so there's no concern there, so that concern doesn't apply. We've been over the other two, which is pretty much the same argument of, because the people go first, does it give the people an unfair advantage and the defendant an unfair disadvantage? It doesn't, because it could break either way. Which really just leads, the only real claim it's left with is this argument from this 1940s Eighth Circuit case that we shouldn't allow pre-deliberations because once a juror says something out loud, they're going to be inclined to stick to what they said publicly rather than try and do what they think is right.
But it's not public, it's within the deliberating body, right?
Exactly.
And the only thing we don't allow that's modern is the Google.
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Basically extraneous information, and we have courts and decisions and rules having to do with extraneous information that's not in evidence.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and I think that kind of sells the broader point of, normally where this court is drawing lines is between intrinsic. We want to have active juries, so we try and do jury procedures that makes the jury more active and less passive. We also want to, and the line we want to draw of what is permissible and impermissible is whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic. And pre-deliberation makes the jury more active intrinsically to the stuff that is presented at trial.
I just want to make sure you're not necessarily asking that we change a rule, though you just think that the Court of Appeals was wrong in this case, that there was no error. What's the extent of your argument? How far do you want us to go in this opinion?
I think you go one of two ways. I would say the less broad holding would be that there's no constitutional error in this case. And that also with instruction, that it's not per se error to allow pre-deliberation in a criminal case, based on the facts presented, which I think given the instructions and the fact that no alternative is present and we don't have that juror secrecy problem in this case, I think that'd be a good ruling. I think this court could say that pre-deliberation is permissible. That'd be a broader holding, but based on the same grounds that just there's no good reason, there's no constitutional reason to prevent it, and I think it's far more consistent with this court's previous jury procedure cases to hold that deliberation is permissible and helps the jury reach a better result. Okay, I see I'm kind of running short on time, so I want to just briefly address the challenge for cause claim. Just a couple of points on that. The Court of Appeals held that the trial court erred in holding a hearing of challenges for cause in the presence of the jury. That's wrong for two reasons. One, it asked the wrong question, and two, to the extent it asked the right question, it reached the wrong answer. As this court recognized in Owens and under the Constitution, this court has the authority to issue rules of criminal procedure. It has, and in Rule 57, it says, rules which are not controlled by any applicable rules or authority, a court can act in any lawful manner. There's no dispute that no rule in Colorado controls whether or not challenges for cause have to be held outside the presence of the jury. If anything, the one rule that glances on this is Crim P 24, and it suggests that they do not. So I think in that context, the issue in this case is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in deciding to hear the challenge for cause in the presence of the jury. The Court of Appeals got the analysis backwards, because what it did was instead it started with the premise of, well, what do we think is the best rule? What's the best practice? And then from there, it then evaluated the trial court's decision. And because it didn't mesh up with what it believed to be best practice, it held that the trial court erred. That wasn't the question. It was an abuse of discretion question. And I think for the same reasons that it wasn't abuse of discretion also shows why I think the Court of Appeals rule is incorrect. I do want to point out that our position is that not that challenges for cause always have to be held in the presence of the jury. It's just that sometimes they can, and that should be a matter that's left to the trial court's discretion, as we leave many important issues to the trial court's discretion. As in this case, there's really no good reason to hold the challenges for cause outside the presence of the jury. The challenges for cause are based on statements that the prospective jurors said in public, and the challenges for cause were not insulting in any way of which it needs to be held outside the presence of the jury.
Are you limiting that to the specific challenges raised in this case, or are you making that as a general proposition?
Specific to this case.
Okay.
And as a general proposition, I do think there are lots of cases where it would be better to hold it outside the presence of the jury. I think the only issue before this court is whether that has to be a categorical rule.
Based on this record, that the defendant truly even objected to this practice? I mean, the way I read the exchange, it was simply, do you want to do these in the back? No, I want to do them here. And was that actually an objection?
It's a proposition, as we said in the brief, that it's not an objection, and the plain error review would apply. And to the extent this court disagrees with me on whether or not challenges for cause should be held outside the presence of the jury, it obviously wasn't obvious in this case because there's no authority on it as of now. It certainly wasn't substantial because the jurors he challenged for cause were later struck with peremptory strikes, so they didn't actually end up serving.
Mr. Lee, I think follow up with a question. The difficulty is in trying to assess this from
at the trial court is you don't know what the challenges for cause are going to be to make that decision as to whether you do it in the presence or not. And I'm, the second concern I have is that would that chill someone's ability to challenge somebody for cause? Because if they challenge somebody saying, I don't think they can be fair, you know, do they have concerns about whether that juror could stay? Can you address those issues?
Yeah. Sometimes yes, it is hard to sell. It is hard to tell. Sometimes no. In this case, I think it was obvious based on voir dire what the challenges for cause would be. The three jurors, two said that they wouldn't want to serve on the jury. They wouldn't want themselves to be on the jury if they were being tried. It was a drug case. The other jurors said, I really don't like drugs. So I think those were, it was pretty clear what the challenge for cause were going to be. And then to answer the second question, I mean, given the nature of those responses and the fact that they were in public, I don't really think it chills the jury's answers. I think it's...
Not the juror's answers, but the defense counsel or prosecution, either side, to challenge somebody that may not be sustained, and then you've got to use a peremptory challenge to strike that person.
Because the challenges for cause have to be based on these sworn statements that have already been made, I don't think it chills because all you're doing when you're raising a challenge for cause is you are repeating what's already been said in court.
Actually, can I follow up on that? Because I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that. I mean, there might be information in a juror questionnaire that gives rise to concern about a juror's ability to serve impartially. And I guess my question is, and this sort of follows up on Justice Boatwright's question, the trial judge doesn't necessarily know in advance the nature of the particular or the basis for the particular challenge for cause. And here, at least on these facts, it's not, what is that trial judge supposed to do at the moment, shouldn't occur here, where defense counsel or the prosecution says, I'd like to do this at sidebar? I mean, how do we assess abuse of discretion at that point when the trial judge doesn't know at that juncture what the nature of the base, what the nature of the challenge is going to be?
Well, I guess generally, counsel should edify exactly why it should be done at the sidebar. And then we would have a basis to review the trial court's decision.
You're saying that just didn't happen here?
Well, it didn't happen here, and I think, and that's what I'm saying, I don't think we need the categorical rule, is because in some cases, there's just not that need. And that's why we don't need the categorical rule.
I think that, Mr. Lee, that the judge's statement that the lawyer, that they were asked a trick question by the lawyer, played a part here?
No, because we have full rehabilitation by the trial court.
He took it back afterwards, you mean?
No, just that the jurors would be able to apply the instructions, would be able to hold the people to their burden. And also the jurors are struck, most importantly. So if this court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining of my time for response and rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Kratz?
Good morning. My name is Alan Kratz, representing Mr. Roderick Flockhart in this case. Before addressing the premature deliberations and for cause issues, I would like to briefly touch upon the sort of standalone issue in this case, the issue of whether the trial judge should have recused himself. Well, this court has repeatedly held that under Canon 3 of the Code of Judicial Conduct, a judge must recuse himself where his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. This can give rise to due process violation as well under In re Murchison. So even if a judge is firmly convinced of his own impartiality, a reviewing court has a responsibility to eliminate even a semblance of doubt on the issue. Now, a point of emphasis...
Even without the mechanism of the challenge and so on and so forth? I mean, straighten me out. When was this issue first raised?
Well, we, defense counsel filed a motion for substitution of judge pre-trial.
Okay.
There was a hearing on the issue. The judge decided that he remembered his prior prosecution, Mr. Flockhart. He had a good memory of many of the details of that prosecution, that it was also a drug case, that it was an unsuccessful prosecution because the motion to suppress evidence was granted, apparently a large quantity of, this is from the judge's own memory, apparently a large quantity of marijuana was found in a home that Mr. Flockhart either owned or rented. But for, due to some problem with the warrant, apparently, the motion to suppress was granted. So although when he was acting as a district attorney, he opposed that motion, he lost, and it was unsuccessful. But despite all those facts, the judge decided that after thinking long and hard about it, he could still be unbiased.
So you would agree this is an appearance of bias issue, not actual bias, right?
Correct.
Mr. Krause, can I follow up with that? Sure. Was the motion based on the fact that the judge, they indicated their position was the judge had actual bias, or did they say there was an appearance of bias, and do you think there's a difference?
I do think there's a difference. However, I think the judge at the hearing considered both issues, whether he was actually biased and whether there was an appearance of bias. I believe it's page 8 of the hearing, the judge recognizes that he has a sua sponte duty, in fact, to consider whether there's an appearance of impropriety as well. So even assuming arguendo that there's not enough evidence here of actual bias, and there probably isn't because this is pre-trial, we don't have much of a record regarding what the judge thought at that time, there's still that appearance of impropriety claim, and I believe it was properly preserved for that reason, that the judge did consider it in his hearing.
I'm not challenging you. I'm just trying to make sure that's...
I have it here. Excuse me. The judge states, I think on these things we need to be cautious as judges and weigh even the appearance of any sort of impropriety or conflict or prejudice. So that was clearly on his mind as well, whether there was an appearance of impropriety in this case.
Did he make a finding that there wasn't an appearance, or did he just indicate that that was on his mind?
His findings were simply that he didn't think there was a problem. I think they were fairly general in nature.
Broad.
Yes.
Mr. Krause, I can't find it. I'm trying to find it unsuccessfully, but I recall he said, I remember this guy.
This is a hearing from May 31st, 2006.
Right. He said, I remember him. This happened 6 years ago. It was a motion to suppress, which I lost, and that judges have to be fair, and I could be fair, stuff like that, right? Didn't he say that? I remember him individually.
Yes. And on page 8, I'm reading from the record. He says, so I'm at a loss, quite frankly, to find something beyond that. I think on these things, we need to be cautious as judges and weighing even the appearance of any sort of impropriety or conflict or prejudice.
Says that I could be fair, as I
yes.
recall. And he indicated it was 6 years ago, right?
It was approximately 6 years ago, yes. So, Mr. Blockhart is not arguing that merely because he formerly was a prosecutor in that judicial district, that itself creates an appearance of impropriety. Nor even does the fact that he previously prosecuted Mr. Flockhart necessarily give rise to an appearance of impropriety. But I think what's critical here are the specific facts, that the judge had a clear memory of that prior prosecution and how it was unsuccessful, and even the reasons for that lack of success. So it's not a question of whether the judge himself thought that that made him biased, but whether a reasonable observer would conclude that there is at least a reasonable doubt as to whether the judge could be impartial in this case. Well, I'd like to turn now to the pre-deliberation issues.
Before you move on, can you talk about the remedy?
Right.
I mean, I assume Mr. Lee is going to stand up and say you get no remedy here.
Yes, well, this court, of course, has considered appearance of impropriety claims several times on direct review. In Botham, this court ordered a new trial based at least in part on an appearance of impropriety on the part of the trial judge. In Burke, which is a pretty old case, this court discussed how when you have an appearance of impropriety claim, the problem is that it creates an unacceptable risk to the fairness of the trial, that there's an unacceptable danger the judge will have an unconscious bias or prejudice against the defendant.
This is a jury trial, right?
Yes.
And I guess I'm having real trouble with the whole concept that a conviction should be reversed for this kind of a business, because, you know, really what the challenge does, or the self-examination, the sua sponte self-examination, is really to go through whether the judge can perform his or her duty in the case. And we have a record, and without any obvious reason to show that any of this played out in the actual trial to the prejudice of the defendant, I'm having real trouble with the concept, because we have a duty to serve. That has to be weighed. You would agree with that?
I would agree.
Right in this? And after you've made the self-examination and you do everything in the trial that's according to the procedures that protect due process, I'm having a hard time with the remedy. Really am.
Well, what is critical is that the judge doesn't just have a duty to examine his own thoughts and feelings and whether he thinks he can be fair and impartial, but he also has a duty to examine the appearance of impropriety aspect of it.
Whether, who's concerned?
I mean, whether a reasonable observer would.
We have a lot of contacts that happen to us in practice. You know, when we come in judge, we take the oath to be a judge. You know, I'm very concerned about, you know, disqualifying people who obviously are fit to serve because of the fray of the battle, if you will, that advocates go through.
Well, I think that presuming that they're fit to serve merely because they believe they're not biased or impartial.
I didn't say that. They go through a whole process to get on the bench and they take an oath. The idea that your past can come up at any time and disqualify you because of some interaction that came out of your practice. I mean, I heard the disclaimers you made, but I'm not convinced.
Well, yeah, again, I'm not arguing that a judge who's previously prosecuted a defendant necessarily must recuse himself. It really is a fact-specific inquiry.
Of course, because your memory is better than other people's memory, right?
Sure. If a reasonable observer looks at the judge's knowledge of that prior case, and including the fact that he unsuccessfully prosecuted the defendant in that prior case based on what some might call a legal technicality, rather than the lack of the total lack of evidence in the case, a reasonable observer, given those facts and circumstances, might question the partiality of the judge in that case. And that's the whole test for appearance of impropriety.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with that last leap. I mean, are you asking us to draw the inference that the judge, as a former DA, would hold that adverse ruling against the defendant?
That is an actual bias sort of argument.
Right, and that's, I guess I'm trying to see what perceives to be some intersection.
The argument is not based on whether on the judge's actual feelings about it, whether he thinks that won't make any difference in my rulings. The appearance of impropriety claim is based on an objective test based on a reasonable observer.
But why would the reasonable observer draw that inference unless we assume that the logic chain is, and therefore because the DA lost the motion, he harbors ill will against this particular defendant and is going to act in a biased way? I mean, that's the appearance,
yeah,
right?
That's correct. And I think that it's based upon what a reasonable observer would believe the judge might unconsciously do. And I think the cases that are cited in the briefs discuss that it's not a question of whether the judge actually thinks I can't be impartial in this case. It's a question of whether all of his rulings are going to be unconsciously affected by that prior proceeding.
We don't have, if we're pretty clear that there is no actual bias and it's simply an appearance issue, who or what is injured by that? Is it just the integrity of the system at large? And if it is the integrity of the system at large, I go back to Justice Ide's question about the remedy for that.
Well, again, as Justice Bender stated in Julian, the problem is that because of this possible unconscious bias, it infects the entire proceeding. It's a type of structure.
Excuse me, that was a dissent.
That was a dissent. I just wanted to point that out. I mean, I did get the votes from the majority in that.
Well, the majority opinion did not reach that issue because there was no appearance of impropriety in the first place. But in Bottom, this court reversed in part based on appearance of impropriety. In Burke, this court discussed at length how the danger with an appearance of impropriety claim is the danger that the judge will have an unconscious bias or prejudice that will affect every ruling in the case and everything he does.
Counsel, how about the more recent cases of Gallegos and AG where we say that actual bias goes to the credibility of the conviction? How do those statements square with your theory?
Well, in AG, of course, that was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And I think it's a completely different standard of review under those circumstances, because in AG, the defendant merely alleged that there was an appearance of impropriety, but made no allegation that the fairness of the proceedings was impacted in any way. And of course, with respect to an ineffective claim under Strickland, defense counsel, or the defendant, has to prove prejudice, a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceeding would have been different. And given this lack of allegation that the fairness of the trial would have been impacted, was impacted in any way by the appearance of impropriety, this court held that that particular prong could not be proven because the allegation, even if true, would not establish prejudice. But this court has never applied that kind of test in determining whether an appearance of impropriety claim, a preserved appearance of impropriety claim, should be reversed on direct appeal. In that situation, this court examines the whether there's a risk to the fairness of the proceedings.
So essentially, you're saying that, I mean, this is just back where we started with Justice Boatwright, but that actual bias in appearance cases should be treated the same in terms of remedy. They both go to the credibility of the conviction or the our assurance that the
Yes, and it's, of course, it's not common that this court finds an appearance of impropriety. So when the remedy is to order a new trial, it's not like we're opening up the floodgates here. It's very rare that appearance of impropriety exists. Another example would be Barden, the Court of Appeals case, where the Court of Appeals found an appearance of impropriety and remanded for new sentencing because of the possibility that that appearance of impropriety affected the court's decision in imposing sentence.
Can I ask one last on this? So just to summarize, do I understand your position right that you think this is an appearance only because in denying the motion, because of the way the judge expressed himself in denying the motion, that he conceded he remembered the case and that he lost?
I'm arguing that there's an appearance of impropriety based upon all of the circumstances surrounding this. That, of course, we have the fact that the judge had actually prosecuted Mr. Flockhart in a prior case. The record indicates that the judge was heavily involved in that prosecution, if not the sole prosecutor in that case. So that the judge, when he was a prosecutor, opposed the motion to suppress evidence, but that was unsuccessful. That the case was not that long ago, about 5 or 6 years, that the judge still remembered that case and the details of it. And that given all those circumstances, an appearance of impropriety arose.
Bob, when you're narrowing that, and even the way you said it there, it seems that necessary to the conclusion that there was an appearance in this case is the fact that he conceded he remembered it and he remembered losing.
I do think that's a critical factor, that if you had a case where the judge had no memory of a prior prosecution, or for example, if you had a case where the judge remembered that he was in the district attorney's office at that time, but had little or no involvement in that particular prosecution. Obviously, those would be important facts in considering whether an appearance of impropriety existed.
So the ability to articulate publicly and go through the thought process transparently, then.
But it's not so
much an issue here. He expressed it rather than sitting on it.
It's what the judge remembers, what he remembers about that prior case is obviously an important consideration. And I think the case law bears that out. Well, I hope I can turn now to the operations issue. I did not think that it would take so long with that first question.
Well, are there more issues?
A couple more. Of course, the Court of Appeals in this case held that the repeated instruction, premature deliberations instructions, was error of a constitutional magnitude. This is consistent with two other Court of Appeals cases, Preciado Flores and Baird, I believe is the name of the other one. This court has also, I think what's critical is this court has also recently acknowledged that an instruction prohibiting premature deliberations is vital to safeguarding a defendant's due process rights. Now in Medina from 2005, this court upheld the practice of allowing jurors to pose questions to witnesses during the course of trial, but only as long as certain procedural safeguards were put in place. And one of the most important of these was the instruction to the jury prohibiting them from engaging in premature deliberations. So I believe Medina already has rejected this notion that allowing the jurors to prematurely deliberate presents no due process problem. Now, as the Court of Appeals has observed, there is also a consensus among numerous other courts that have considered this issue that it creates a constitutional violation. These holdings recognize certain common sense aspects or foibles of human nature, that when premature deliberations are permitted, jurors' initial views are likely or more likely to be pro-prosecution, given that the prosecution presents its case first. And that once a juror forms such opinions, and especially once a juror expresses such views, it is human nature for that juror to seek to defend that view, such that she is likely to continue to adhere to that opinion despite later contrary evidence, or at least likely to, as Justice Rice put it, likely to require a subtle burden shifting, such that their mind can only be changed if the defense presents sufficient evidence.
Scott, if you could address two points. They're a little different. First, as far as I know, there's no empirical research one way or the other concerning criminal pre-deliberation discussions.
As far as I can tell, that's correct.
If that being the case, and there is pretty good research now supporting the other areas of jury reform.
Yes.
So I guess the first question is, absent empirical research one way or the other, isn't it a little premature for us to conclude that that is a constitutional violation?
I would heartily agree with that, yes.
All right. And then secondly, it seems to me that the argument you're making and that you made, I mean, I appreciate it, not any way meant to denigrate it, is really based on what we think in human nature. And I can certainly tell you that in my own personal anecdotal experiences, jurors always talk about stuff among themselves anyway, irrespective of whatever the instruction is. So I don't think we should be changing our rules or making a constitutional rule based on what we sort of think happens, which might in fact be accurate, but we got to prove that first.
I think that's correct, that obviously jurors will not always follow instructions. For example, the instruction that the defendant enjoys a presumption of innocence, there's no guarantee that a juror is going to follow that instruction. But that doesn't mean that the instruction...
No, I'm not arguing against the instructions, of course. But I don't think we should make a rule of constitutional magnitude based on, you are starting to argue, human experience and human nature and that sort of thing. That's all.
I'd say it another way. Why impose a gag rule when you brought in a group of citizens whose ultimate job is to get along with each other, respectfully disagree, and work it out? So at the start, you basically tell them, well, don't do that until you get in the room, whether you actually have the case in front of you, and then you can start talking with each other.
Yeah,
that just doesn't seem to comport with, at least I'm going to say, contemporary ideas of what their role is, you know, and maybe historical ideas of what their role should have been, but we didn't allow for some reason, because we offended human nature by telling them they can't talk with each other when they've got to, actually, that's why they're there.
Well, this court, of course, there had been a rule in Colorado for a long time prohibiting premature deliberations. Now, as Justice Bender notes, there's not any case law from this court talking about it in constitutional terms.
Right.
I'd be perfectly happy with this court affirming the Court of Appeals without getting into the constitutional question. But I do believe,
based on the,
I do believe that that allowing premature deliberations implicates.
But well, what's the basis for reversal? What's the basis for reversal if we assume it's a non-constitutional violation?
You mean the basis for affirmance?
Right. Yeah. Well, reversal on top.
Right. Well, I still think is that it's human nature again that jurors. Well, especially when they're allowed to discuss the case, that they will tend to form opinions not only about the evidence, but form conclusions about guilt prematurely. Now, we can say, yeah, this might happen anyway, but I don't think that's a good argument for eliminating an instruction that at least seeks to guarantee the defendant's due process rights by prohibiting the jurors from engaging in this practice.
Oh, I mean, okay. That doesn't get you to where you have to go, right? I mean, if we say it's error, why is it a harmful error in this case?
Well, again, it's because of
the violation of the rule?
Yes, and the dangers this presents to a defendant's due process, right? The dangers of the shifting of the burden of proof, the likelihood that once a juror has formed an opinion and especially expressed that opinion, that they will view subsequent evidence through a distorted lens. This, of course, is the phenomenon of confirmation bias, which is a very well-recognized sort of bias that can occur when someone forms an opinion prematurely without having received all of the evidence in the case.
Also, could I ask you a little bit about, it seems like a lot of these criminal cases that have found this to be problematic all sort of stem from this Weinbrenner case from the Eighth Circuit, which articulate these human nature, common sense sort of approach to what we think, how jurors operate. If those are to be deemed true, or we uphold those as truisms, doesn't that apply then across the board to civil context as well? And if so, then why are we allowing this type of process to occur without problem or violations of anybody's due process rights in the civil context? And if not, then what is unique about the criminal trial context that would make it okay for civil trials but not okay for criminal trials?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a couple of things that distinguish criminal trials from civil trials. First, I think, is the, again, a sort of common sense notion that criminal trials tend to involve issues in which people are more emotionally invested in, and they're more emotionally charged than the average civil trial. And for that reason, there's a greater likelihood of the type of confirmation bias that I've spoken of. Secondly, I think it's critical to note that in criminal trials, the instructions the jury is initially given normally do not present any theory of the defense type of instruction to the jury. The jury normally in a criminal trial is given standard legal principle instructions and often the elements of the offense, which is sort of a roadmap for guilt. On the other hand, the defense instructions, such as affirmative defense instructions, theory of the defense instructions, will normally not be given to the jury initially in their juror notebooks because the defense must present evidence to support those instructions. Now, it's my understanding that this is not the normal practice in civil trials, that normally they are given much more complete instructions right at the beginning of the case. And so that's another reason why there's a greater risk, again, that the premature deliberations will lead to this kind of pro-prosecution bias and the subtle shifting of the burden of proof compared to civil cases.
That's kind of an interesting point, because we don't have affirmative defense instructions for the purposes of this particular case. And in fact, I think your opponent mentioned that in this particular case, the jury had been fully instructed along with this pre-deliberation discussion instruction. Is that, am I?
Well, again, but it's not only the instructions, of course, it's also arguments that are presented at the close of the case, which present, for example, defense closing argument presents the defense in a complete fashion and helps the defense discuss the nuances of the defense. Of course, the jury isn't exposed to that. At a time when they're presumably prematurely deliberating. I just think there's a number of that's just a factor, I think, as to why it's a bad idea to, as a general practice, allow premature deliberations in a case.
We obviously do in the civil context, and so I guess I'm just trying to tease out from a logical standpoint why it now reverts that very same process becomes constitutional error when it is conducted in a criminal trial. And I'm just trying to isolate exactly what about the criminal trial makes it so, aside from, you know, these are emotional issues. I mean, you could have a personal injury case. It could be a very medical malpractice case. It could be very powerful emotional testimony. So I'm struggling with that one. Maybe you can offer me some more.
Well, yeah, I do think that given that civil trials, for example, have a different standard of proof, merely preponderance of the evidence normally. Criminal trials, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So any sort of burden shifting is much more damaging when you're dealing with a criminal trial than a civil trial. I know I already mentioned it, but I think that the issues involved in many criminal trials are far more likely to lead to the kind of confirmation bias that numerous courts in other jurisdictions have recognized as presenting a problem to a defendant's due process right.
Well, the basis is what I think Justice Rice said, right? That there's a subtle shift, or yes. Can be a subtle shift, and pretty much that's because criminal trials, generally speaking, are pretty short, and the majority of them, there is no evidence presented by the defense, right?
Correct. In this case, the defense did present evidence, but yes, in many criminal trials.
I think that the hardest thing for jurors to understand in criminal cases is, you know, you ask lots of jurors if you think they can be fair, and they say, well, yeah, I can hear both sides. And then you have to explain to them in a criminal case that there's not necessarily going to be both sides.
That's true.
That the burden of proof doesn't demand that there be both sides. And that's a very different sort of approach than in civil cases where there are generally both sides. That preponderance is such a different burden of proof, and the whole approach one takes to civil cases is constitutionally quite different. My concern is that really is a very real risk of burden shifting if you don't impress upon the jurors right from the beginning that being fair in a criminal case is different. It's not listening to both sides. It's determining whether the prosecutor has proven his case or not.
I think that's a good point, Your Honor, that in a criminal case, it's critical that jurors be given the proper instructions, that just because the defense doesn't present a case, that's not something they can consider as evidence of guilt, that the prosecution bears the sole burden of proving the elements.
How do we handle this particular point right now in the trial courts? I mean, what's the general protocol when jurors are voir dire for their service at the beginning, or whatever talk the judge gives to the jurors about their service in a criminal case?
Well, the judge normally gives the standard admonitions that presumption of innocence exists, the prosecution bears the burden of proving each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt. Jurors are normally told that this presumption exists throughout the trial proceedings and does not disappear unless and until the prosecution has met its burden of proof. But the point that many courts make is that this is the kind of subtle burden shifting which occurs primarily at an unconscious level. Jurors may believe that they're still abiding by the court's instructions regarding presumption of innocence and burden of proof, but because of the premature deliberation process, this subtle burden shifting is going on.
Short. There was conversation about the length of trial. Do you know how long this trial lasted?
I believe it was 3 days.
And do you think that subtle burden shifting happens with pre-deliberations to a greater extent in short trials or lengthy trials? Or do you have a position?
I'm not sure I have much of a position on that. Justice Bender seems to indicate it happens more in short trials, unless I'm mistaken about what he was saying.
Decency and privacy.
I think it could happen in either kind of trial.
Okay.
the disturbance that can occur.
Thank you.
I guess I run out of time to talk about the for cause issue.
Unless the court has questions.
What rule do you want us to write?
I think the Court of Appeals correctly held that challenges for cause should not be heard, should not be conducted in the jury's presence.
And it should be reversible error if they are.
Well, the Court of Appeals in this court held that there was no plain error. I would argue that the error arguably was preserved. The court was given an opportunity to conduct the proceedings out of the hearing of the jury and chose not to, despite the defendant's proposal that it do so. But even if the error is not preserved, I think it's plain error in this case, because I think it's very obvious that when challenges for cause are made in the presence of the jury panel, that this creates the danger that the jurors who are challenged will bear an unconscious animus or hostility against the person making the challenge for cause, because challenges are necessarily based on critical statements about that juror. In this case, for example, counsel had to argue that the jurors were unable to follow the court's instructions on the presumption of innocence. One juror, there was an argument that juror simply could not fairly evaluate the credibility of witnesses based on a friendship with a particular person. So because these comments are necessarily critical of a juror, it's obvious that courts should avoid holding challenges for cause in front of the jury. And this court recognized as much in Medina also, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kratz. Mr. Lee, we'll give you a few extra minutes if you want it.
I'd like to begin with the judicial recusal claim, if I may. And I hate to be predictable, but defendant has no remedy.
There is a distinction between appearance bias claims and actual bias claims. The very fact that we have those two categories tells this court much of what it needs to know. Actual bias claims allege actual bias and actual prejudice. Appearance of bias claims do not. As this court explained in AG, the rule prohibiting a judge from sitting for appearance of bias claims is to protect the public's confidence in judicial integrity. It's a right that belongs to the public, and it's a right that belongs to the judiciary. Nothing about reversing a defendant's conviction after that harm has been completely sustained mitigates that harm. The harm has been completed. By reversing a defendant's conviction when there's no dispute that the verdict was prejudiced at all that does is serve to undermine the integrity even more.
There was harm here?
Sorry.
Do you think there was harm here, Mr. Lee? Do you think there was harm, or do you think that there was an appearance of bias?
There was not an appearance of bias in this case, no, Your Honor.
Is that because this was simply a separate prosecution, or why?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. The cases that defense counsel cites pretty much go to the per se rule that prior association with an agency that was involved with one of the litigants requires disqualification. This court has rejected that in Schuper and AG and Julian, just based on the pragmatic understanding that, you know, in certain counties, especially the one we have here, there's just not that many judges and that many attorneys. Most judges have pretty lengthy histories of practice before they become judges. And it's a very strange rule to presume bias just based on the idea that a judge previously worked on a case to kind of vindicate this idea that promotes judicial integrity. I think the better rule is that when judges take the oath, that they can be fair and impartial to all the litigants that appear before them. Specifically to the facts of this case, I don't think there's appearance of bias. One big key to this case is the case was dismissed on the judge who was then a prosecutor's own initiative. Some of the cases the defendant cites where the judge successfully was able to prosecute the defendant, I think that creates a different inference. Here the judge, on his own motion after losing the suppression motion, decided to dismiss the case of the defendant. I think based on that, it doesn't really create the same sense of impropriety that other outcomes may have. But I think my final point on this is just the defendant has no remedy in this case.
whatever harm that was sustained was already sustained, and we only further undermine the integrity by reversing based on that conviction. To escape that holding, I think I heard defense counsel cite Aetna v. Mutual Assurance and In re Mutchinson, which are two U.S. Supreme Court cases. Both those cases reversed based on actual bias. To the extent that they suggested in dictum, which I will agree, that there might be some rights to have a judge who appears to not be biased, doesn't really say much, because in Colorado we already have that right. Our judicial canons tell us that a judge should recuse if they think there's an appearance of bias. So I don't think that gets us away from the fact that the defendant has no remedy. Certainly constitutional errors can be harmless, statutory errors can be harmless, rule of evidence violations can be harmless, certainly violations of canons can be harmless.
So I guess you don't take the position, though, that there is no remedy. I mean, your suggestion in your briefs, at least, is that the Rule 21 procedure is the proper remedy?
Yes. Yes. And I think that better vindicates the rule that we're trying to protect. The issue...
Why is that?
Oh, yes, sure. The thing we're trying to prevent is a judge who appears biased from sitting. Really, the only way we can do that is by having that ruling, if it's wrong, reversed at the outset before it's already completed. And the only way to do that is through Rule 21.
I guess your position is, though, that we don't really have to reach the remedy question because there was no appearance in this case, or?
Both, yeah, either way.
Okay.
I guess in my dream world, opinion would say that there is no remedy in criminal cases, just pretty much following the reasoning of AG, although I think it's pretty clear and it clearly applies to this case, but also that there was the judge was correct in not recusing himself because there was no appearance of bias in this case. Okay, turning back to the pre-deliberation issue, I think I just have a couple of points on that because I see I'm running low on time. Justice Rice's question of whether or not the stakes are different in a criminal versus a civil case.
The burden.
And I guess my response to that question is, in this case, the jury was fully instructed at the beginning of the case. They received the instruction on burdens, presumption of innocence, and the stock instruction that we normally get at the end of the defendant has no burden to present any evidence. So I think given that, that concern doesn't really arise. And I think that's common in most trials that you now, at the beginning under Rule 24, get those instructions at the beginning of trial.
How does that play out, though, under your opponent's scenario where someone raises some sort of affirmative defense and the jury would not be instructed until that juncture of trial?
I think the affirmative defense would always come up during opening statements. And I think whenever we look at instructions, we always look at what the attorneys argue to the jury. And in affirmative defense cases, that always comes up in opening statements. So I think even in that instance, the jury would be fully instructed. Kind of taking a step back to whether or not it's different from civil and criminal, whether the stakes are different. I think another issue is to the extent that there's a greater concern that the jury is going to want to hear more in criminal cases than it does in civil cases. Nothing about pre-deliberation adds to that. That happens in non-pre-deliberation cases. One of the benefits of pre-deliberation is that by having discussions throughout trial, you have a group of jurors who all hear the instructions. And I think the presumption has to be that most jurors understand and follow the court's instructions. So you kind of get this group policing. If someone shows that they're not following the correct instructions, you have 11, or sometimes you have an alternate 12 jurors reminding the jury about the correct instructions. So to the extent that that is an issue, I think pre-deliberation better battles that than non-pre-deliberation. If this court has no further questions.
Talk actually before yes. You leave the podium about, let's say we disagree with you and conclude that this is error. Talk a little bit about the nature of the review of that error. I mean, I take it your backup position is send it back and find out if pre-deliberation even occurred in this case. My follow-up question on that is, that doesn't get you very far. If the answer is yes, then what?
Okay. I guess my first position would be that if this court disagrees that pre-deliberation should be allowed, I would strongly urge this court to hold that it's not constitutional error, and especially if it's not constitutional error in this case, given all the things we've previously discussed.
In that case, a remand would not be necessary. So I think based on this record, this court certainly could conclude that the defendant suffered no prejudice under non-constitutional harmless error review. To the extent that there is a remand, the only issue, the only position that we have taken is that there should be a remand. Of course, before a court reverses, it should always know whether or not the error actually occurred. It's not good enough that the error may have occurred. To the extent that we can find out whether, to the extent that we actually know if the error occurred, we should. So if it turns out that on remand that we're unable to prove that pre-deliberation did not occur, and this court finds that that is reversible error, I would not dispute that.
Mr. Chief Justice. May I, for this is called the bench, the bar, and the citizenry here. I just want to say that, you know, to the extent that a piece of furniture can be important, this bench, this is the last day for its existence, and it's been an old friend in many ways. It's the only piece, really, that we brought over from the old courthouse that's going to disappear after today. So I just wanted to make note that it's a privilege to hear your arguments and to be around this bench this morning.
It's a small bench, but there are those who love it.
I love it too.
Speak for yourself.
So that I would ask the court to affirm the defense convictions and vacate the court of appeals opinion to the extent that we challenge the
thank you. Do you want to take a recess?
Yeah, I'd like to. We'll take a recess. The court will be recessed for 15 minutes.